This week on Vox Talks, why is Silicon Valley so successful? And how can other places get a piece of the action? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. You hear a lot of talk about tech clusters, but what precisely are they? And why have some of them, Silicon Valley's obviously the first one that comes to mind, become so successful? Can cities create their own cluster using a policy or incentive? And are all the good and the bad things we hear about their impact on regional economies really true? This is the focus of a new CEPR discussion paper on these clusters called, surprise, surprise, Tech Clusters, as by William Kerr and Frédéric Robert Nicou. Bill Kerr joins me today from Harvard Business School to talk about the answers to these questions, but also the surprising number of things we still don't know about tech clusters. Bill, welcome to Vox Talks.
Tim, thanks for having me.
When we think of tech clusters, as I've already said, of course, we think of Silicon Valley, the number one success story. Can you give us some idea of how concentrated innovation and investment has become in that tiny little part of the world?
Sure. Silicon Valley for the United States is about 2% of its population. And Silicon Valley here, I'll broadly include the San Francisco area as well as Oakland. So the San Francisco Bay Area, about 2% of the population. But for patenting, it's about 17% or thereabouts. And it's half of the venture capital investment that's done inside of the United States. This is reflective of a more broad kind of concentration of innovation that look at our top 10 tech clusters in the United States. They're about a quarter of the U.S. population, but they're half of patenting and about 90% of venture capital. So very concentrated activity in a relatively small parts of the country.
So in this paper, you're trying to make some general points about tech clusters. So what is a tech cluster? How big or how productive does a region have to be to qualify to call itself a tech cluster?
Your introduction emphasized a lot of the open questions, and I think you hit our very first open question, which is, how do we label a tech cluster? And I think the one of the key questions about this to begin is it about intent or is it about outcomes? And this being a podcast that's listened to by a bunch of economists, we would understand the challenges of when you select on outcomes. You would already have the places we label as a tech cluster being quite strong in observables today, whereas you know we get nervous about that sometimes. On the other hand, if you focus just purely on intent, well, virtually every town, village, and medium-sized city, as well as every large city, has declared themselves to be pursuing a tech cluster dream. So our dialogue takes readers through thinking about how we've traditionally defined these four clusters and how we might have to change that for tech clusters. So traditional cluster definitions would emphasize both scale and then linked activities. And so what are the benefits that scale can provide? Well, scale is just going to have a sheer mass of nearby activity that you can facilitate specialized inputs. Those could be physical inputs like a lab center or something that wouldn't make sense in a small location, or it can be in terms of professional services. You go to your average lawyer in a mid-sized town in the United States, they're going to be a general-purpose business lawyer, whereas in the Boston area, we have lawyers that specialize on very particular M&A transactions. That's a very specific input that can make sense at this scale. And then there's also kind of the matching that we can do of workers to the best opportunities that happens in these big clusters. So that's the scale side. Then there's all the linked activities and how the whole becomes more than just the sum of its parts and kind of that productivity extra edge. But I think those two are very general historical ways we've thought about clusters. And we've added on, you know, our hypothesis that we need to have a definition that includes some frontier edge to it. We would not declare Detroit right now to be a tech cluster, even though Detroit produces lots and lots of patents. It has scale. It certainly has linked activities. But what we try to think about is that the technology work that's being done inside that cluster is shaping and impacting many sectors of the economy. And that's a hypothesis to how we might best define this going forward. But a lot of work needs to be done by both theorists and also empirical research to help sharpen these definitions a little bit more.
So we're saying that in any cluster that at its time is at the leading edge, we can consider to have been a tech cluster. We always had these spillovers, these concentrated labor markets. But there's something fundamentally different about a tech cluster in 2020 compared to 1970.
I think if you take the academic version of our definition that we just gave, we would be trying to create a framework to think about how a tech cluster in the early 1900s, which Detroit was easily the Silicon Valley of its day back in that point in time, how a definition that could apply very well at that point in time also can apply today and try to create that continuity. Because we've seen the frontier edge of technology constantly move. Cleveland had a very prominent period. Silicon Valley was really a spot on the map, 50 years ago. And it wasn't until the 1970s, 1980s that it really kind of took off and came to where it is right now. So we'd be trying to find something that's more general. Now, one of the things we play around a little bit in the chapter is thinking about when can clusters come into being a tech cluster and when do they leave? So if we say that Detroit was a tech cluster in the early 1900s and it was the Silicon Valley of its day, then at some point we kind of took away its tech cluster badge. And defining exactly when we did that is not easy. Likewise, Wall Street. Do you consider Wall Street to be a tech cluster? And most people are instantly like, no, that's finance. But Goldman Sachs has more engineers that it employs than the entire workforce of LinkedIn and Twitter combined. And there's many of the quantitative hedge funds that are at the frontier of artificial intelligence. Blockchain has potential to reshape large parts of commerce. And I think the jury's still out on which way Wall Street is going to go. Is it going to stay specialized around financial services and its inputs and its needs? Or is it going to become more of this fintech hotspot for the future? That'll have to play out. And so we're going to have to explore how we exactly define the spillover across sectors and being this general purpose technology that is impacting multiple industry lines and segments to help clarify where the tech cluster starts and stops.
Well, one of the interesting things, as you point out, is the nature of technology now. 50 years ago, what made Silicon Valley great was hardware-based technology innovation, but no one's taking away its badge as a tech cluster because it is attracting investors and startups in biotech, fintech, AI. This seems to be a way in which tech clusters now can have longevity. Their technology is so applicable in a wider range of business applications.
I think there are a couple points that you just brought out that maybe we can tease them out separately. One is the concept and idea of like, why do we often see the new ideas spring up nearby where the older edge of the technology exists. And there's a lot of work that's been done in economics over the last 50 years, starting with Jane Jacobs and continuing onwards, to think about where ideas are most likely to be born. Some of the models and concepts deal with diversity of inputs, and that most of our new concepts are not something that we just create out of whole cloth, like from scratch, but instead are recombinations of ideas that we already have in different forms and building up a new business, a new opportunity set around that. And so the places like Silicon Valley and London and so forth that sit at the frontier often have this local diversity that's able to help facilitate this. Another thing we connect this to is it's not always serendipity. A lot of times it is serendipity, but it's not always serendipity. And when it's not serendipity, it's often associated with very frontier talent and researchers. One of the reasons why Toronto is so prominent in artificial intelligence right now is history. A few key AI people back when, before AI was what we think of it as now, when it was an emerging technology but had nothing of the implications that we are currently experiencing, they decided to be located in Toronto. And that kind of gave the seed to what is now a very prominent community. So those pieces are what help ideas be born inside some of the existing tech clusters. And then go back to many of the specialized inputs that I was describing. If you're trying to build one of these companies and you need to have a talented workforce that's able to do frontier software development and programming, you got to raise money from venture investors who can understand and wait for 8 years, 10 years before a return is realized. And oh, by the way, only probably 15, 20% likelihood that this is actually going to work out. And think about the legal side that we highlighted a little before. Those specialized inputs are very, very difficult to recreate elsewhere, and they also give a stickiness to this place. That being said, all of these clusters do have their stronger themes or the things that they emphasize a little bit more. And you certainly see this inside of a city as to how things are specialized. The Kendall Square area that's right near MIT has become ever more biotech focused, such that some of the other industry groups in our area are moving closer to the seaport or into the financial district or places where the rents are a little bit more favorable for them and they can still get the inputs that they desire.
One of the things, as you point out in the paper, that confuses any attempt to draw general conclusions about what tech clusters are is the fact that cities tend to self-declare that they have tech clusters in them. You've got Silicon Peach, that's Atlanta, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Silicon Spuds, which is Idaho. Is Idaho the potato state?
Yes.
I was concentrating in geography, yes. After all. Yes. Yeah. In London, there's an area not far from our studio here, and that's seductively known as Silicon Roundabout. What are the social benefits of having a tech cluster in a city? It makes people so desperate to claim that they've got one.
Well, I think even before we get to the economic benefits, there are political benefits. There's a branding benefit. If you're trying to encourage local development and be seen to be doing something for your local populace, it's attractive to say we're going to become a tech cluster. You can get a lot of energy and support around that. There are economic studies that do point to the strong jobs that these companies are generating. And the companies that we're thinking about as being located in the Silicon Roundabout will typically be very well-paying companies, attracting people and ideally at some point making a profit and also paying business taxes. But Enrico Moretti has even further work that shows that there's about 5 spillover jobs for every 1 job in the sector, which is 2 to 3 times higher than what we observe for manufacturing. So there's at least the seeds for being a productive spillover beyond just the companies and the jobs that are directly in the sector in terms of helping the local area in development. The other thing I would highlight is this goes to a broader question that many companies, many towns and cities are grappling with right now, which is how do we attract global youth and talent? And you can see this not only at the macro level in terms of young people wanting to go and work in a London or a New York City or in the San Francisco area. You can also see it at the micro level. There are a lot of people that will want to work with a Silicon Valley company, but want to live up in downtown San Francisco. And they're trying to create the types of businesses and opportunities that are going to be attractive for bringing them in. I think a statistic that can help think about this in my book, it's called The Gift of Global Talent. It tries to think about how high-skilled migration has linked into this tech cluster phenomenon, is that if you go back to 1995, about 1 in every 220 patents in America was either invented or co-invented by an Indian or Chinese living in the San Francisco Bay Area. So a relatively small amount might have gotten a local news story, but was not something that really made your head turn. If you look at it today, it's about 1 in every 12 patents in the United States. And so that means that if you were to take the output of the 28 states in America that produce the least amount of patenting, that's about 1 out of every 12 patents. It is a phenomenal concentration that has come in large part by being an attractive place for young global talent to come live and do their work. And cities, while they're talking about their specific proposal for building the Silicon Roundabout in their area, often that's part of a broader theme of we need to be able to grab global youth and help be a place where they want to live and do their work. And as we all go through aging demographics, as each of our countries gets older, this competition is going to heat up even more.
So, Bill, I'm a policymaker, imagine, and I've been given the job of creating one of these tech clusters on my doorstep. You can see why many people will be given that job. Do we know enough about what makes tech clusters succeed that we can give policy advice on what to do in this case?
I think it's a tricky area. Policymakers are going to want to go there, and they should collect as much counsel along the way as they can. So let's try to break this into a couple pieces. One is, if you remember nothing else, go get my colleague Josh Lerner's book, The Boulevard of Broken Dreams, because it's going to talk about the sheer number of times we've tried to create a Silicon Valley somewhere and it's not worked.
Mm.
It kind of goes to the challenges that top-down mandates have and why they can be risky. And a lot of that goes back to just how intricate the ecosystem is. So what we can tell policymakers is, first, don't try to pick winners. All the studies that say, if I want to put a whole bunch of money into company X, that's not going to work. It may work for you if you just get super lucky, but as a consistent strategy, it's not going to be able to be long-term successful. Where it gets a little bit more challenging to say if it's going to work or not is when cities make sector-level bets. So New York has some very specific policies that are connected to the finance and the fashion industries. They see those as opportunities for where the city has a competitive edge, and they want to do things to help reinforce that. I think the evidence right now, you certainly can't say that that's overall a bad policy. It's, again, it's got its trickiness, and you have to worry about just cronyism or missing what could be that great new thing that doesn't get the attention that your traditional sectors have had. But there's some potential for policy around that. And then more broadly, I think there's an interesting new wave of work that's being done with cities trying to help seed a bit of the ecosystem or create the right infrastructure for that ecosystem to take root. In the Boston area, over the last decade, we put into place the Boston Innovation District. And that was not trying to say that it is going to be exactly about this technology or here are the companies that we're going to put money into. But instead, the city worked to free up some area that we could attempt to concentrate some of this activity in, make sure that there was a housing stock in that area that could be accessible to people that are making six figures as a computer programmer, but they're not a multimillionaire, that there would be a university presence that was inside of that cluster, as well as some big company presence in addition to the venture side. So it was trying to think about, these are the ingredients that we know need to sit in an ecosystem. Can we create an environment that helps those kinds of pieces come together in fruition? And the last thing I would highlight is that if you want to just get started in this, you know, there are some things that you could do through the private sector that don't even need to be, you know, the public sector directly. The Cambridge Innovation Center, it's now called CIC in the Boston area, has been expanding to a number of other cities and tries to create a spot where a lot of startups can come and work together. They're basically trying to harness the ecosystem. And in the Boston area, they have thousands of people that are working inside the CIC in many different ventures. And they've raised more money than, I think, like the state of Pennsylvania in terms of their venture investment. They've gone and they've recreated this model with success in many other cities. And what it highlights is that this is a private company. It doesn't always have to be a policy-driven initiative. It can be that they say, hey, CIC, could you come here? Can we coordinate some of the private sector to come around and help us create this ecosystem?
One thing it is very important to point out, though, Bill, isn't it, that it's not all good news having a tech cluster. There are some negative impacts for the people who live in the region and for businesses within that area. What are those?
Always want to start, and this is true in my PhD class as well as also with business leaders when interacting with them, to emphasize that a cluster is an outcome, is an equilibrium concept. So there are costs that go into the cluster, and then there are the benefits that come out of that. That has implications if you are a graduate student for how you're going to write down your economic model and what you're going to try to estimate. If you're a business leader, it has implications for saying, you may dream that by going to Silicon Valley and opening up your center there, that you're going to get access to all these wonderful ideas and that you're going to have this digital talent available to you that you've never had before. And that's the rosy side of it. The opposite side of this, well, maybe some of your ideas are also going to filter out into the local area. And maybe also some of your employees are going to say, hey, that job across the street's pretty attractive. And so for some organizations, this may mean that locating in the talent cluster, the tech cluster is the right choice. For others, they may say, you know what, for our current position and what we need to be successful, we're actually better off at a distance from whatever the predominant tech cluster is for their industry space. And economics has actually done a lot of nice research around some of those trade-offs and helping to think through role of firm-specific capital versus industry-specific capital, how you can think about some of these trade-offs. Then you get to this second level, which is thinking about what is the implications of this competition. And there are people that are going to be upset about being pushed out of tech clusters or facing really the higher rents that come with this. And some of that is not something that economists tend to worry about too much. Example would be, you would be insane if you were a chemicals manufacturing company and you decide to go and locate your headquarters or your plant, your office building, right in the middle of Wall Street or right on Sand Hill Road in Silicon Valley. or right on, you know, Market Street in downtown San Francisco or near the Silicon Roundabout. You don't receive the benefits from being in that location. And so what the price system is doing is it's helping create fidelity around the tech cluster or around what is going on in that space. And that's not something that economists tend to worry too much about. And instead, it's part of how these clusters form and operate and how the whole system of cities and the dynamics work out. There are, however, more difficult and challenging sides to this, which is it's also is raising the housing costs for families that have lived in areas for a long period of time. And we've seen in a number of leading tech clusters, Silicon Valley being especially true, a lot of outcry against being pushed out of their homes, the rising housing costs. A few years ago, there were protests that were held against the buses that the tech giants used to take people that live in San Francisco to their workplaces in Silicon Valley and go back and forth. And protesters blocked the buses and were saying, you guys live in a world full of sushi and palatial campuses and get all these benefits. All we get are rising costs. And then the last thing that is also connected in here is people are starting to worry more about like a loss of place, in that the more new people you have coming into the area and the more that people coming from many different backgrounds are seeing new opportunities and the less they know particularly the way things used to be done there or the way it has traditionally been done. And in some cases, that's fantastic because the way it was traditionally done is not something that should be kept going forward. But there is some increasing worry about tech clusters, leading talent places, losing some of their historical identity. This can be at the district level, can be at the neighborhood level, can also be at the overall city level. Things that were special about the place just aren't being appreciated by the people that have just come in. And they may only be there 3 or 4 years before they're shooting off somewhere else. But that can have implications for how the city perceives and feels itself.
So, Bill, there is a lot of work that can be done, both at a theoretical and at a policy level, so that we know more about these tech clusters. Also, to make sure that today's tech clusters don't end up like Detroit has ended up. Do we know enough that we can get on with this work and do some of the research that needs to be done?
I think we have two types of research streams. So let me get at the one that's further along. We are learning a lot more about how tech clusters operate. We so far have kept the same broad framing that we've used in other work, talking about what are often known as the Marshallian spillovers of knowledge diffusion, labor pooling, the industrial organization complements, as well as also the natural advantages that local areas bring. We have to port that framework into the new environment, thinking about the role of tacit knowledge and networks among inventors for tech centers. In the labor world, we talk about non-compete clauses and natural advantages. We're moving more to thinking about universities and their lab sets. But a lot of that framing still works very well. And I think we've got a lot of nice action items that we can offer, especially if there's an area where a tech cluster is struggling and wants to improve. There's places we can go and point to guidance. What is less developed is what helps a cluster take root in one location versus another. This is difficult for us in large part because, first, we only have so many of them. It's not like we have thousands and thousands of N here that we can work with. And a lot of the roots of places happened a long time ago. And so this is not where we're using our latest data sets from 2019 and their administrative records, and you got everything linked up between the employer and the employee. This is often archival work to try to understand what were the conditions that allowed Detroit to emerge as the leading center for the automotive sector over a bunch of other places. That work is going to be much more ongoing. And then I think to go to your Detroit example, what I think we have, especially given the challenges that the United States and the UK and other places have had with deindustrialization and a lot of the social anxiety and the economic inequality and so forth, we've got to think a lot more about how we can understand when is a place that's a predominant cluster likely to be very fragile. And is there something that we can do in that setting in order to make it more robust? It was the 1980s, which is not that long ago. I was certainly alive in the 1980s. Flint, Michigan, which is a much more challenging case than even Detroit, Michigan. Flint, Michigan was declared the young person's mecca. It was the place where talented young people were going. And Detroit at that time was frequently top five city, if not at the very top, in terms of income per capita. ultimately, it proved to be fragile with globalization and the changes that happened. Detroit may, with the electric vehicle and autonomous driving and so forth, reemerge on the scene. Let's not count Motown out yet, but we've appreciated much more over the last decade even how much we need to understand the sensitivity around here. Now, I'm not worried about London in the near future, even with some of the questions you have about Brexit and so forth. I think London and New York and some of these cities that have achieved a scale makes it less sensitive to any one particular industry that's at risk. And likewise, we are also observing ever more the power couple phenomenon, a husband-wife team, and one of them is a healthcare CEO and the other is a startup founder. The capacity of these big talent clusters, broadening the term beyond tech clusters deliberately to say talent clusters, the power of these big talent clusters to let both of them do their work is very productive and is going to, I think, have a lot of long-term roots that it creates for some of these places at the very upper parts of the scale. You may still struggle to pay $40,000 a year for your child's preschooling, but you will both be able to work in the same city in quite different sectors and have lots of resources at your disposal.
Well, one piece of advice I have for anyone who wants to create a talent cluster is don't call it Silicon Spuds. Bill, thank you very much for that.
I appreciate it, Tim. Thanks for having me.
As Bill points out, there's a lot of scope for more research if you fancy doing some of it. Well, first of all, why not read Bill's paper? It's called Tech Clusters. It's by William Kerr and Frederic Robernico, and it's DP 14143. I also ought to mention your book, Bill. It's The Gift of Global Talent.
It is. It's about high-skilled migration around the world and how it impacts particularly places like London and New York and Silicon Valley, those that we've been discussing. And the book, and especially the midsection, draws out this very tight linking between why tech clusters are becoming so prominent with the global talent phenomenon.
It's very relevant for this. And we also ought to mention Josh Lerner's book, Boulevard of Broken Dreams.
And the other one I mentioned along the way was Enrico Moretti, and he's got The New Geography of Jobs. So we got lots of reading material for everybody.
There is a lot of homework for anyone who's listening to Vox Talks this week. Bill, thank you very much. This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. We're here every Friday with everything that's interesting in economic research, so subscribe and you won't miss an episode. And if you do, you can always find it at voxeu.org/vox-talks.